Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up this hour, plenty of interesting conversations, including the conversation with Tony Lays of the Des Moines Register. He's their healthcare reporter on new measures, new metrics of measuring coronavirus in the sewage. Also, Katie Pike is on a ruling this week that went against an effort to block a new California animal confinement law. Of course, Iowa pork producers very interested in that. Cornell College political scientist Megan Goldberg on State Representative Christina Bohannon's bid for Congress in Iowa's 2nd District. And toward the end of the hour, I'll talk with an Iowa woman who recently swam around Manhattan Island, in its rivers, about 30 miles. It took her about 8 hours. We'll get to that later in the hour. But first, Iowa's public schools are completing their first week back in class. Teachers and students physically back in classrooms, of course, at a time when Iowa's infection rate has jumped considerably since the beginning of the month. We're joined now by IPR's Grant Gerlach, covers a lot of our education issues. Hi, Grant.
Good to be back, Ben.
Of course, the ban on mask mandates put in place by Governor Reynolds and Republican lawmakers center of attention in this first week of the return to classes. What can you tell us about the ripples this week from that controversy?
Yeah, well, that mask mandate ban that was passed as part of kind of a wide-ranging bill in May, that continues to stand, and that continues to be the law in Iowa. Of course, Iowa is one of several states that has either a law or an executive order that stops schools from issuing mask mandates, so they cannot require students or teachers or other staff members to wear a mask in school. And so that's how we've started this school year. And leading up to the year, there was a lot of discussion about this, about whether schools would try to challenge that state law, because we've been seeing that in some other states, or whether schools would try to find other ways around it, whether they would create masked classrooms that were optional, but everyone who is in that classroom chooses to wear a mask. So far, what we've seen is that school districts themselves have not challenged Iowa's law, and they have not been going for these opt-in classrooms that some parents have been calling for. And so classes have gone forward. Districts have been starting this week with students having the choice to wear a mask, and school districts encouraging that, recommending that, by and large, you know, recommending that people follow the CDC guidelines for universal masking. But as it stands right now, that is not a requirement that they can make.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I had UNI President Mark Nook on the program yesterday, and, you know, he was not defying the ban on mask mandates there at that university in Cedar Falls either, having to follow through with what the Regents has handed down and state law has handed down there. When you look, though, Grant, at other states, we do have superintendents and other officials in similar positions defying their state's bans on mask mandates. In fact, an interesting one, and I don't know how this one turned out in Texas, I read that one, maybe multiple school districts got around the ban by making it a part of their dress code rules, which are entirely part of the superintendent's purview there. So interesting, but in Iowa, not defying this ban on mask mandates.
Well, there has been some pressure for schools to do that. You know, for instance, I think some people thought maybe Des Moines would take that step because last year Des Moines started the year all online when they didn't have state permission to do so, and they were supposed to start at least half in person. But this week, the district came out and made it clear that they're not planning to go against this state law. The school board chair, Tawana Bradley, put out a video statement Wednesday saying that the district supports universal masking. That's what they're recommending. They want everyone to follow those guidelines. But She said the only way they can require it is if Governor Reynolds, Governor Kim Reynolds, gives permission for districts like Des Moines to issue a mandate. And, you know, perhaps if she suspended the ban that was passed in May. But to this point, Governor Reynolds has given no indication that she plans to back off that law. In fact, she, in all of her statements, she continues to stand with the position, her belief that parents should decide whether students wear masks or not.
Mm-hmm. Related to this, you also reported on this week, Grant, a Council Bluffs parent challenging this new law that stops schools from issuing mask mandates. Tell us about that lawsuit.
Right. Since districts have not taken this step, there have been some citizens who have said they're interested in taking that step, and Fran Parr is the first. She's a mother with two twin boys in first grade in Council Bluffs, and she's got this lawsuit against the governor, the Department of Education, Education Director Ann Lebo, and the director of the Iowa Department of Public Health, Kelly Garcia, and she's challenging this law against school mask mandates. She, like I said, she has these two boys in Council Bluffs schools, and she says that what she wants is for them to be able to be in an environment with universal masking. And she also wants them to be in person. She's told me this week that last year they spent almost the whole year, about 75% of the year, with virtual school, and then part of the year in person, and she noticed the difference with what they were learning and how quickly they were picking things up in person versus online. And so she wants them to be in person, but she doesn't think she should be forced into putting them in an environment where they may be vulnerable to the coronavirus because they're under 12, they can't be vaccinated, and they may have classmates who aren't wearing a mask. So the lawsuit is asking for, first of all, they're asking for an injunction against the mask mandate ban. They're also asking the court to require the governor to issue a universal mask mandate at least until schools can create spaces for students to all wear masks or not wear masks.
Mm-hmm. Any sense on how slow-moving or quick-moving this lawsuit will be in the court system?
I'm sure they'd like to get a hearing quickly on at least the injunction part of it. I haven't seen that scheduled yet, so I'm sure it'll take a little while.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Grant, you said that the governor is firm in her position, but what is the talk about any contingency plans for schools? Should we see in some communities a spike in infection rates, as we certainly did last year in schools?
Yeah, and we know that those events will happen. We've already seen some foreshadowing. There's a district in Western Iowa, AHS2W, in Avoca, and they put off the start of school because there was a large number of teachers exposed to the coronavirus at an in-service meeting. Des Moines schools closed administrative buildings because of a number of infections among administrative staff. So these are the kinds of things that can happen. And it's not unreasonable to expect an outbreak at some point in some district across the state.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is not really well laid out. I think it'll sort of be decided on a case-by-case basis, whether it's just a classroom that's closed down or a school. That's something that each district is going to have to address as it happens with the Department of Education and their local health department.
Yeah, but isn't it clear that compared to last year, last school year, superintendents are not as flexible in their reaction to what happens in the coming weeks, given the strictures put on them by the state government, right?
Well, yeah, and you may remember last year we had all these thresholds that could trigger hybrid learning or it could trigger virtual learning. That stuff is not around this year because the state has told districts that they should treat the coronavirus like other illnesses in schools. So once absence rates reach 10% in a school, they're supposed to report it to the state, and then the conversation goes from there about how they're going to respond. So, no, there are not a lot of immediate options for school districts to follow except to keep parents informed and keep working with the state on what they can do to react.
Grant, you have kids in the Des Moines School District, and you report on this. And what can you say about the atmosphere in schools, in classrooms, among parents this first week?
Well, I thought that the first day of school on Wednesday here felt pretty familiar, like a first day of school. We drove up to drop them off. They're varsity football players waiting to greet them as they got out of the car. It felt like that familiar celebration of the first day of school. And so far, whatever reports we can get out of them when they get home, it sounds like things have been pretty normal in the classroom too. So I'm grateful that there is some of that familiarity around school so far. I think the question that lingers in my mind and a lot of people's mind is, how long can this last, and will it be disrupted at some point by an outbreak? And that's sort of what just kind of lingers in the background here.
Right. And reports from higher education, when we focused on that yesterday on this program, are that students in classrooms are not, for the most part, wearing masks, and they are at full capacity, and there's no social distancing requirement there. Can you say anything about how many masks you saw in your school district dropping kids off? Are they complying with the wishes to wear masks or not?
Yeah, this is very mixed, and I think it's mixed everywhere you go. As far as the classrooms that we're familiar with, there has been a pretty high percentage of students wearing a mask. But there have been anecdotal reports that I've seen of classes of students where most are not wearing masks. So it's going to be difficult to get a broad perspective on the numbers of cases that are appearing in schools, how quickly the virus is spreading in schools, and just kind of what impact it's having, aside from reports that may come out eventually of classrooms having to close or potentially schools having to close because of the virus.
Okay, Grant Gerlach, we'll keep our fingers crossed and keep attuned to your reporting. IPR's Grant Gerlach covering the education beat K through 12 for us at the beginning of this new school year. Grant, thank you so much.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, after a year and a half covering this pandemic, I was surprised this week to run into an aspect that was new, well, to me at least. A new report showing the amount of coronavirus floating in Des Moines area sewage has more than doubled in 2 weeks. Tony Lace covered the report for the Des Moines Register. He's the Des Moines Register's healthcare reporter. Hi, Tony.
Hey, Ben.
Are these new reports a new metric to measure the presence of COVID-19 virus in the community?
The idea of doing this has been around for a few years. The federal government has been encouraging local governments and colleges to try to do this over the last year or so, and Des Moines agreed to do it this summer.
Mm-hmm. And what did this particular report show about Des Moines area sewage?
Well, it's a pretty rough measure, but what they do is pretty straightforward. They take a sample at the main sewage plant, which serves 17 cities in and around Des Moines, and then they send that sample to a national lab, and they look at how much coronavirus is in it, and they standardize it so they're comparing apples to apples as far as the concentration of the samples in it.
And so we can, with this metric, compare the Des Moines area to other metropolitan areas in the country.
That's right. One of the Des Moines officials overseeing this said to me, not everyone goes in for a COVID test, but everyone uses the bathroom.
All right. What is the significance here you see in this new measure as a health reporter?
I mean, it confirms what a lot of other measures are showing, is that the coronavirus is very prevalent in this area. In some ways, I think this technique would be more useful if it were a rarer germ or virus out there. so that you could say, is it present in a community or not? I think at this point, the coronavirus is present in every community. It's just, these tests indicate it's really present in the Des Moines area.
Mm-hmm. And so we could, this would be one measure, you put it up against, you know, what we're seeing as far as the rate of infection in the Des Moines community, graph that, compare it to this, and we could see what we would presume would be those graphs being somewhat in sync, wouldn't we?
Right. And the idea also is that this is can give an advance warning, because at this point, you know, the other measures we're looking at lag a little bit, like hospitalizations is probably the one that we're looking at most. Well, those are people who got infected several weeks ago and then, you know, got progressively sicker. This would, in theory anyway, show up quicker, and it's showing a big jump over the last couple of weeks.
And analyzing sewage is not anything new. I understand, for instance, prescription drugs, the remnants of prescription drugs can be found in sewage. So we know that, for instance.
Right. That was one of the first uses of it. It is an idea that is gaining some traction nationally, and the coronavirus sort of gave them an opportunity to test it out on a larger scale. At this point, it's not being used a lot to drive action, but it could be in theory. Like, if you're the CDC, you could say, looking at these tests from all over the country, here are the spots that have the most virus. That's where we should really focus our efforts. I mean, that's the kind of thing that could be going forward.
Do we know if this sort of testing will continue in Des Moines and in communities around the country?
Des Moines has decided, so it was almost like a free trial offer for several weeks from the federal government. Des Moines has decided to continue doing it for a couple more months and pay for it. They said it's about $750 a week. They think it's interesting data. I mean, they're only doing the sampling in one spot. They're not trying to go upstream to try to find out, like, which communities have the most, which you, in theory, could do, but they're not doing anything that specific.
Okay, very interesting. Tony Lays, Des Moines Register healthcare reporter. He covered this week a new report showing the amount of coronavirus floating in Des Moines area sewage has more than doubled in 2 weeks. Tony, thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. An update this week on a story that has Californians potentially bringing home less Iowa-produced bacon starting in January. Katie Pikus is with us, agricultural reporter for Iowa Public Radio. Hi, Katie.
Hey, Ben.
Remind us about this proposition. We've been reporting on this here at Iowa Public Radio. This is a proposition passed by California voters back in 2018 to go into effect January 1st.
Right. So basically, Proposition 12 prohibits confining animals in very small spaces. And under the law, a business owner isn't allowed to sell pork from breeding pigs that were individually confined in less than 24 square feet of space. And as you said, this law is set to take effect on January 1st, 2022.
Okay. Iowa pork producers, of course, that's a huge market for pork producers. Iowa, the number one pork producing state in the country. So obviously losing the California market, because I understand, Katie, most of Iowa's pork producers would not meet these new California standards, would they?
That's true. And the Iowa Pork Producers Association, they did argue in federal court earlier this month that complying with this new law would sharply increase their costs. I mean, they would have to make a lot of adaptations to their facilities to meet this new law.
Okay, so there was a judge in federal court ruling this week what?
Right. So federal judge C.J. Williams, he simply tossed out the case. I mean, he ruled in favor of California officials that wanted the case to be dismissed. And one of the reasons that the judge said was that there is not proof that California intended to harm Iowa pork producers when California voters passed this proposition. And he also said that the court in Iowa just doesn't have jurisdiction over the California officials who were named in this lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting here because California voters, of course, I don't think anybody would quibble with the fact that California, residents of California, the voters should be able to decide, how the produce, how the meat is raised for sale in California, their standards. But California is such a huge market. It makes me think of how California, what the standards California has for automobiles, Katie, can dictate what the big car makers in our country do, right? So this is kind of the same thing. California voters saying we want what they would see as more humane treatment of all kinds of animals, but pigs in this case, and that having real ripples to the chief pig pork producing state in the country, Iowa.
Right. I mean, when you think of how big a pork producing state Iowa is, you know, the chief pork producing state in the country, this will have big ripple effects in Iowa. At the same time, a lawyer for pork producers in Iowa told me that right now they are assessing their next steps in the case. So where we go from here, from the ruling from this judge, is still a question.
Mm-hmm. How big of a blow would this be to Iowa pork producers? If it goes through, they're looking at their next steps. We'll find in the coming weeks what those are. But how big of a blow would this be to Iowa pork producers or pork producers across the country?
I'm not sure that I have an economic figure on this at the moment, but I did speak with the attorney for pork producers in Iowa, and he said, you know, it would be very difficult for pork producers to comply with this law. They would have to shift their housing from, you know, right now housing breeding pigs in individual crates. They would have to go to group sow housing. And he told me that would cost producers a lot of money to make this shift. And he did say, you know, it would be very difficult, extremely difficult. You never want to use the word impossible. He said it can be done, but it would be extremely difficult and very costly to make these adaptations.
Katie Pikus, IPR's ag reporter, thanks for the update on this. Katie, we'll look forward to you covering this issue as it has new updates in the coming weeks.
Thanks, Ben.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. When we do come back, I'll talk with Megan Goldberg. She's Cornell College political scientist there. I'll talk to her about State Representative Christina Bohannon's bid for Congress in Iowa's 2nd District. Also, a conversation. This is fascinating. A woman who recently swam around Manhattan Island. I'll talk with her after a short break. It's your NewsBuzz edition. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment.
Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com. This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
It's our NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll get to know an Iowa woman, a swimmer, not just any swimmer, an open water swimmer. She recently swam around Manhattan Island, nearly 30 miles of swimming continuously in the rivers surrounding Manhattan Island. Took her about 8 hours. Just for the fun of it? We'll find out in just a moment. But first, this week, Democratic State Representative Christina Bohannon announced she's running for Congress for Iowa's 2nd Congressional District. Bohannon, a law professor and a former engineer who lives in Iowa City, is trying to recapture the Southeast Iowa seat for Democrats. In her announcement video, she highlighted her rural, working-class upbringing.
I'm Christina Bohannon. I grew up in a trailer in a small town, and my parents never finished high school. My dad was a construction worker, working long hours in the hot sun for little pay. When I was in high school, Dad got sick. Then his health insurance was canceled, forcing us to choose between paying for his medicine and paying for everything else. But my teachers and my community never gave up on me, and I got a fair shot. I worked hard to earn my way through engineering school and law school, becoming the first in my family to graduate college.
Until 2020, Iowa's 2nd District had been considered the state's most reliably Democratic congressional district. Then came that razor-thin win in 2020 by Marionette Miller Meeks over Rita Hart. Joining us to talk about this 2022 matchup, Megan Goldberg, Assistant Professor of American Politics at Cornell College in Mount Vernon. Hello, Megan.
Hi, Ben. Great to be here.
How do you size up Bohannon as a candidate against Miller Meeks? We have a law professor, engineer with a blue-collar family background here.
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, in a lot of ways, she's a very traditional candidate. She's been doing a lot of fundraising over the summer, especially for the state party. And, you know, she's got experience at the state house. She's got that law background. So in a lot of ways, she's a traditional candidate. But I think that this sort of emphasizing her background is going to be really strategic. And, you know, she represents more Iowa City right now, but capturing the rest of the district in a what will probably be an extremely competitive race. Mm-hmm. That's sort of a strategy to appeal to those other voters.
Miller Meeks welcomed Bohannon to the race, but criticized, Megan, her opposition to a ban on mask mandates, also criticized her opposition to the so-called Back the Blue bill. What will make the difference in winning this district? Which voters is each campaign focused on?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is probably the most competitive district in Iowa. We saw that, right, in the last election. And so what Miller Meeks is doing is really appealing to those extremely divisive issues that really polarize the two parties right now. And so what I think Bohannon has talked about is really focusing on constituent service, reaching out. And so that's something that she might be able to use to appeal to independent voters. But I think the other thing that both of these voters are going to care a lot about is in a midterm election, getting their voters to turn out. That midterm, it's a much more focused on a turnout problem than a persuasion problem.
Mm-hmm. And a lot at stake for both parties here. The Democrats, such a slim majority in the U.S. House, 220 seats for the Democrats, 212 for the Republicans. So we'll watch this in the months to come. Thanks for the initial reaction to this matchup. Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Of course, many of us enjoy swimming, but it's safe to say few of us enjoy aquatics as much as my next guest. Earlier this summer, 34-year-old Liz Uribe of Iowa City swam around Manhattan Island. Yes, around Manhattan Island in New York City. The course was just under 30 miles long. It took her around 8 hours of continuous swimming. This is just the latest of her amazing aquatic feats. Liz, welcome to our program.
Hi, Ben.
Well, great to have you on. Full disclosure, you and I belong to the same open water swimming club, ICOWS, Iowa City Open Water Swimmers. Start off by giving us a quick idea of the course you took around Manhattan Island.
So we started at Pier A in Battery Park and then went counterclockwise around the island, starting in the East Rivers and then into the Harlem River. And then we finished in the Hudson River, back at Battery Park. That's the way we went around the island.
Yeah, in fact, this is an established swim. It's called the 20 Bridges Swim. So you swim under famous bridges past landmark buildings, don't you?
Yes. So we swim under, like you mentioned, under the 20, like the main sort of big 20 bridges around the island that connect the island to the mainland and the other islands around that area. And then we also, like, I swam past the UN building and a lot of like the fun sort of, interesting and sort of sights to see in New York. So
An interesting way to see the sights from down in the water. You have a kayaker next to you. So you're swimming in these rivers. Does that mean that some of the time you're with the river current, sometimes against, or how does that feel as a swimmer?
So So you mentioned having a kayaker. The New York Open Water Swimming Organization assigns kayakers for this swim, specifically because the currents and the tides around the island with the three rivers can get kind of complicated. So you do have to start sort of at a certain time to make sure that you're hitting the currents the right way and the tides the right way. And you have to get past a certain point before the tides turn around or the currents switch. And if you don't get past that point, there's no way that you can finish the swim around the island. The currents and the tides are sort of complicated there. And I was really fortunate that my kayaker was amazing and was very, very experienced. And so she kind of zigzagged me across, you know, from side to side, depending on where the currents were the best, so that I would get the best sort of current assist while I was swimming.
Mm-hmm. Liz, why did you want to do this swim?
So I'll step back a little bit. So my mother and I supported a friend on his Catalina swim back in 2016. And watching him swim, my mother turned and looked at me and she said, "You could do this." It wasn't a question. She said it with absolute certainty. When she said this, I looked at her and I said, yes, I could do that. And so I did. I swam the Catalina Channel the next year. And the Catalina Channel, along with the 20 Bridges Swim, is part of something that is known as the Triple Crown of Open Water Swimming. And so after I did the Catalina Channel, I thought I might as well go ahead and do 20 Bridges. I'd never been to New York. What a great excuse to go to New York. And it looked fun. I'd seen a few of my other open water swimming friends do this swim, and it just looked like a fun swim. And so so I did it this year.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the reason. You know, it was one of the three, and it was close to home, and it looked fun.
Right.
And it was fun.
For those not acquainted with Catalina, Catalina is an island close to, off the coast, next to Los Angeles, and that's a 20-some mile swim that you you did a while ago. And in this swim, because it's so unusual, much different, I assume, than an open ocean swim which you had off the coast, off the West Coast. Were there any sort of unexpected challenges you faced that you only realized once you got in the water?
Not particularly. I said, my kayaker was very, very experienced with the rivers and sort of the traffic in the area, and so she kept me safe and away from all the boats. It was really interesting to see all the other boats there, and we passed some really sort of heavy duty, like freighter boats and stuff, and so that was kind of different, but. It made the swim feel a lot less lonely, so it was kind of nice. I mean, maybe not to see all that traffic, but to see other people along the way and see other stuff happening going on in the river. So,
mm-hmm. Did you see, were people up on bridges? Could they see you? Did you get any bystanders who were surprised to see you swimming around Manhattan Island?
Yeah, so I distinctly recall seeing a couple of people watching and having with their cameras out, watching us as we went by, sort of on one side. And then my kayaker had moved me over to like the other side to the other shore, to get currents. And I think we actually ran into someone who knew what the swim was. And so they were cheering for me and I could hear them cheer for me. And as we swam by, and it was really cool to see that. I actually think that, despite how big this particular swim is in the open water swimming world, a lot of people in New York actually don't know that it happens. And so when they see swimmers go by in the river, I think a lot of them are like, what is that crazy person doing in the water? I did see quite a few, a number of people with their cameras out, just like watching it swim by, like, what?
Uh-huh. Right. In New York, people might wonder, swimming in these waterways, the waterways of New York, the Hudson, the East River, Harlem Rivers, not known for water quality. Was that a concern?
So I didn't particularly worry about the water quality. And to be honest, I didn't swim into anything weird. There was no trash in the water. There was nothing like horrible in there, like it wasn't bad. I did, it was dirty. So when I got out from when I finished, I did have dirt on my face that I had to sort of wipe off with the towel. But besides that, there wasn't anything like disgusting in the water. So it was okay.
All right. What was the most enjoyable part of this swim for you?
Overall, this was a very like low stress swim, I think, and just like from the very beginning, logistically planning the swim was very easy because I really didn't have to look for any of my support. Travel was fairly simple. It's going to New York. And so overall, it was just like a really easy swim to plan for, which was nice compared to some of my other swims. But I just really enjoyed, I think what I enjoyed the most was seeing those people who were watching us on the shore, or like that person who saw us and cheered for us as we swam by. And I think I also really enjoyed, there was one other person who swam at the same time that I did. We started together. Mm-hmm. And it was just really fun to start with someone else. It was just really fun to swim with someone else. It's always more fun to swim with someone else. So we were fairly close to each other. We were sort of like leapfrogging each other for about the first half of the swim before I kind of pulled ahead and stayed ahead of him. But it was really fun to just have him be like, know that there was someone else with me swimming.
Right. Many listeners will be pool swimmers, but not many listeners will be open water swimmers. What makes open water swimming different, or to you, more alluring than pool swimming? Pool swimming, of course, you condition in the pool. You have to, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So how is open water swimming different or more appealing to you?
So there's something like almost zen-like for me when it comes to open water swimming. You don't have to count laps. You don't have to flip turn. If you've got a good kayaker, you don't even have to sight. So all you have to do is just kind of get in and swim. And you can just kind of stop thinking, really. You can just let your mind sort of wander. You don't have to think about anything. You don't have to worry about anything. You just get in and kind of enjoy the swimming. And so that's really what I like about it, just like the fact that for me it's kind of meditative and relaxing to just go out there and not have to worry about anything else.
As you mentioned, this swim, the Manhattan Island swim, one of the so-called triple crown of open water swimming. You have the Catalina Channel swim off the coast of California behind you. Now this one, the English Channel, is that going to be in your near future?
Yeah, hopefully within the next couple of years, I will get out there and swim the English Channel. That's something that I'm interested in doing.
I have to believe the English Channel poses greater challenges than these two prior swims. Is that true? It's longer and it's colder, right?
So it's not that much longer than the Catalina Channel, but the currents are pretty strong through there. So I think you end up swimming quite a bit more than the Catalina Channel. And then it is a few degrees colder than the Catalina Channel. Although I swam the Catalina Channel, I think I was the first swimmer that year, so really, really early in the season. So the water was quite cold when I swam.
Okay, when you say quite cold, what do you mean by quite cold?
So it was, I think, 63 degrees the whole time that I swam, which, I mean, for comparison, normal sort of recreational pools are kept about 80 or 82. So about full 20 degrees colder in Catalina.
Right. And the English Channel water, likely a little bit lower than that even, huh?
Yeah. So probably high 50s or possibly into the low 60s. It'll be, I think, colder. Unless I'm very super lucky, it'll be colder than my Catalina Channel swim.
Well, we look forward to touching base with you after that successful swim. Congratulations again. Liz Uribe, a open water swimmer, lives in Iowa City, a biostatistician otherwise for Everest Clinical Research. When we post this audio podcast, you can see several photos of Liz from her Manhattan Island swim. Look for those at iowapublicradio.org when you find River to River. Liz, thank you for sharing this great adventure with us. Take care.
Thanks, Ben. You too.
Amazing feats by Iowans. That's what we'll put that. We'll put that in that category. Cece Mitchell is with us. She has amazing music along with her colleagues Mark Simmet and Tony Daner of Iowa Public Radio's Studio One. Hi, Cece.
Hey there, Ben. How's it going?
It's going well. I'm looking at the couple of tunes you're going to share with us. By coincidence, I think you have swimming or a swimmer in the first title here.
Yes, I sure do. I loved that last story. And, you know, I didn't plan for this at all, but here we are. The first track, it's called Swimmer from the new Halfwaif album that's called Mythopoetics. Halfwaif, it sounds like it's a band, but it's actually the project of a single artist. Her name is Nandi Rose, but this is the fifth album she's released under her Halfwaif name. And you're going to be hearing it quite a bit on Studio One tracks, these songs from this album. They're somewhere in between like a singer-songwriter music, her style, but she has these like great danceable electronic beats that go right behind her music, and it really fits into the show. So I love to spin this stuff. It's a track from the new fifth studio album, Mythopoetics by Halfwaif. This track is called Swimmer.
Soft fall of the blanket, you may not know it, but I am loving you with my fingers on your shoulders. I am loving you. I wanted to sing for you, so
Swimmer, the title of that tune by Halfwaif from the new album Mythopoetics, if I pronounce that correctly, Cece Mitchell. I can
yep.
I feel I'm underwater listening to that. How pleasant. What's next?
Right. It's a beautiful song. Our next one is a really pleasant song, too. It's by this band I really like called Shannon and the Clams. I guess another aquatic theme.
There you go.
They have sort of a catchy retro rock sound. It's perfect to groove into the weekend. They have a brand new album that came out last week, their sixth studio album called Year of the Spider. And all of the songs are really fun to listen to and dance to. The one that I picked out is one of the singles from that new album. The album's Year of the Spider, and this track is called All of My Crying.
What a great pick from Shannon and the Clams from the new album Year of the Spider, All of My Crying. Love those two picks. Cece, thank you for grooving us into the weekend. Remind us how people can tune in to you and your colleagues, Mark Simmet, Tony Daner, and all the best in new music and old favorites.
Sure thing. We're on 7 nights a week, 7 to 10 p.m. here on Iowa Public Radio and online. And also we've got a fun show on Saturday afternoons, 2 to 4 as well.
Cece Mitchell, thanks so much. Have a wonderful weekend.
You too, Ben. Thanks.
This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
River to River Today, produced by Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer, Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.